I think it's good for democracy.
I'd like to see the greener issues.
The issues would be for the homeless and the farmers.
Well, they've done something, but they haven't done enough.
There's a few of them need to be turfed out, I think.
Hello, you're listening to an extra edition of the Your Politics Election 2020 podcast. During the campaign, we've been talking to some RTE correspondents to have a look in some cases at the manifestos or the issues that are driving this election campaign. Well, today we're speaking to Ingrid Miley, our industry and employment correspondent, not so much on a manifesto by manifesto basis, but just to look at some of the background to what has maybe thrown up some of the issues like pensions and unhappiness with the state of the economy amongst the electorate that might make this election a little different to some of the other ones. So, Ingrid Miley, I'm talking to Ingrid Miley, our industry and employment correspondent. Ingrid, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome to the podcast. We mentioned you in an earlier podcast because we were talking about pensions. And it had blown up during this, we'll get to it in a moment, but it had blown up during this election as an issue. And I was just saying that you had been talking about this Cassandra-like for quite a while, but nonetheless, anyway, it's there and we'll be talking about it in a while. So let's have a look at some of the issues framing this election, the context behind the election. We're in a different place to where we were in 2011, say, and even in 2016. So what's the landscape like here? The economy is doing well. What's it like for people?
Okay, well, let's look at workers as part of this election campaign. I think one of the big successes that the government can point to is that it now has 2.3 million people at work. That's always an indicator of economic success. That's the highest figure in the history of the state. Unemployment is down at 4.8%, and that is extraordinary when you think it was over 15% in 2012. So I think that, as I said, for the government, that is a plus side.
Right, but in other elections, people say it's the economy, stupid. In this one, opinion polls, which are, with all the usual caveats, snapshots in time and only indications, Sinn Féin by the last one were 25%, Fianna Fáil were 23%, and Fine Gael were 20%. So it's not the economy, stupid.
No, it's not. Because I think what is happening is that while loads and loads of people have jobs, they may not necessarily be very good jobs. And in addition, in their personal lives, they are dealing with the infrastructural bottlenecks and the shortages of public services that are making their lives very difficult. We've gone through them. I'm sure you've gone through them in loads of these podcasts. Housing, health, childcare, as evidenced by that massive protest yesterday. Broadband, for example. So I think if you summed it up, we have loads and loads of people in jobs, but many of them have very poor jobs or poor quality of life.
So the indicators are that the economy is getting better, but as people see the indicators showing the economy getting better, they may look at their own personal circumstances and say, but my life doesn't seem to have significantly improved. What are the factors influencing that particular feeling?
I mean, traditionally, as I said, we have looked at tax as, you know, a headline issue in dealing with workers. This time, people seem to be far more focused on public services. And again, this comes back to the idea, you may have a job, but what's your quality of life like? And I mean, Adrian Kavanagh, the electoral expert.
He's from the University of Maynooth, the Department of Geography in Maynooth. He has compiled a database of candidates and he looks at the numbers on everything from
he's
the general
really,
elections
really
to
smart.
The Eurovision.
He's
yeah.
really, really smart. But I was talking to him and he was making the point that normally a government will get a dividend for a strong economy as we have at the moment, barring that pesky 200 billion of debt that we're still carrying. But he says, paradoxically, if people are not financially on the edge, they have the time to look at what's my life like? And he is saying that a lot of these life, as I said, these lifestyle issues in terms of rent, housing, you know,
childcare,
public broadband,
public
transport, all of these things, that they do seem to be skewing the way that people are looking at the manifestos and saying what the priority is. So basically, on polling day, we'll be looking at, you know, will workers be looking on, you know, at short-term tax gains? What, I suppose it's only then we'll see what promises have gained resonance and which overall vision will prevail. It might be easier, Colm, to break it down into two sectors, if you like. We've got private sector workers and we've got public sector workers, and the framing of their employment situation can be quite different. In the private sector, we've got 2 million people, and they're getting pay rises at the moment averaging about 2.7, 2.8%. I was checking this with my colleagues in Industrial Relations News this morning. They're the vast majority of the workers in this country. But not everybody has a good job. One of the difficulties is we're hearing more and more about the gig economy, precarious work, zero-hour contracts, and a lot of difficulty there. Now, the Nevin Institute, this is an economic think tank funded by trade unions, just yesterday posted research that showed that some forms of precarious work, which they were seeking to roll back, which was inevitable, was going to rise during the crisis. They're finding that some forms of precarious work have settled at levels higher than before the financial crisis.
Now, by precarious work and the gig economy, just before you continue, in terms of those terms, the gig economy is effectively you're paid for nothing other than what you directly do with no contract. So the people who deliver food, couriers, they're paid per delivery.
It's task-based.
Task-based.
And often done through an algorithm like Uber, Deliveroo, whatever. And the question is that an employee or is that not an employee, just a contractor? So there's a whole raft of employment law around that. I'm not going to get bogged down
sure,
in that.
Sure, and precarious work is short-term
could be
or
people
very
on
loose
short-term
contracts,
part-time contracts. One of the issues that arose in that is that almost 40% of people under 30 who are at work are in some kind of atypical work. That's from figures based in 2017. And, you know, a lot of people in part-time employment in Q3 of 2004, that was 16.4%. Q3 of 2018, 19.4%. And another key issue here is underemployment. That is people who are in part-time work who would like more work, because a lot of employers will say people want flexible work, they want flexible hours, but the numbers looking for more work are still significant.
And on the issue that was mentioned by a number of the parties, the issue of home ownership, if people are going into a mortgage broker or a bank, they want to see long-term contracts and predictable income before they lend the money. Based on that income, number one, their income is low, and number two, there isn't a predictable long-term source of income, so mortgages are going to be hard to come by too.
But not just mortgages, rent. Because one of the issues about precarious work, and again, I'm not going to get bogged down in the figures, that there is in-work poverty that is being studied at, you know, quite an intense effort. Because if you don't have security of employment, even getting rent, I mean, you mentioned mortgages, Colm, will you even get a car loan so that you can get to a better quality of job that, you know, might require a car? So, you know, precarious work can have its difficulties. And certainly the unions in the private sector will say that what they want to see is better legal rights to collective bargaining and to organise workers. Now, whether that will come is another issue. But certainly speaking to Patricia King of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions yesterday, she was saying that that is absolutely essential if private sector workers in those difficult employment areas are to get more rights and entitlements.
Now, one of the things that we're finally at the issue that you've been talking about to colleagues around the newsroom for quite a while. The issue.
You sound like I'm boring everybody
to
death.
No, I don't mean you're boring. No, but I mean I have heard you say pensions is big for years, and so it has become big in this particular. Maybe not in the pensions time bomb way that you've been talking about it before, but it has come centre stage in this election, raised at the start of the campaign by Sinn Féin, but raised prior to that by both the Labour Party and People Before Profit as well. What's the issue and why now?
OK, well, it depends on whether you believe there is or isn't a pensions time bomb. Pensions experts around the world believe there is, because people are living longer, and that means that they're going to be claiming a pension for longer. That's going to cost more to fund. And in order to fund pension schemes, you need more people to be working. So there is a disparity in the ability to keep the pension infrastructure sustainable. Now, SIPTU, at the launch of a campaign to stop the rise in the pension qualifying age to 67 recently, their economist Michael Taft said the pensions time bomb is a myth. We have the youngest workforce in Europe, and we're putting our new qualifying age at the highest level, and therefore we don't need to do this. Others will say there is a long-term problem that, you know, if that Ireland has been ahead of the posse in actually addressing this. And if you look at some of the social unrest there has been in France, for example, over the need to increase the pension qualifying age, the retirement age, that is an indicator of the fact that this is not just an Irish problem.
And there have been some moves within the public service to look at career average pensions rather than final salary pensions, even within the political sphere, to raise the age at which people can qualify for a pension. I think it's entrance to politics after the mid-2010s. So there have been moves there, and we've seen progressively in the private sector the doing away with defined benefit pensions and the increased defined contribution pensions.
All of which means that there's that people in retirement have a greater reliance on the state pension, and pushing out the age at which they can claim that state pension, particularly if they have a contract of employment that says they have to retire at 65, there's a gap. And I think there was always going to be, if you like, an issue over how you deal with that. I remember being at the launch of this with Joan Burton and saying, hold on a second, you're saying you're going to allow people to claim job seekers benefit for the intervening years between being forced to retire at 65 and being able to claim the state pension at first 66, then 67 from next year and 68 from 2028. Will they have to, you know, apply for jobs? Will they have to go for interviews? Will they be
after
means
nine
tested?
Months, will there be a means
yeah,
test?
Exactly.
And then they'll have to start living off
savings and what have you. Yeah. And she said, no, it like more or less it'll be grand. And that was the view of the political parties. But it doesn't appear to be grand, because it seems to have annoyed people on a dignity issue and on the inconvenience issue and on, if you like, a sense of entitlement that when people started paying into this system, there was an expectation they'd get their pension at 65. So they're arguing that, OK, it's fine if people are coming into the workforce now and they're told that forever, that's what you're going to get at the end. But I think a lot of the people who have been most militant on this believe that the goalposts were moved midstream, and that's creating an issue. So it has actually forced a political climb down in the course of this election campaign. Whether that will be good from a macroeconomical point of view, whether these, you know, like everybody argued these reforms were absolutely essential for the future sustainability of pensions. Can they now be set at naught, you know, basically on the back of an envelope during an election campaign? I don't know.
All right. We'll see. The other thing that people would have seen, say, for 20 years of elections between the late 1980s and the mid 2000s was social partnership, where employers, unions sat down. There were pay rises agreed. The pace of pay rises were agreed. At a given point in the early 2000s, there was benchmarking to iron out people leapfrogging each other and so-called relativities arising. Post the crash, social partnership fell apart by and large. We have had a series of pay agreements on that. But now that the boom looks like it might be on the verge of getting boomier, this leads to pay claims being put in. So where is that at, and what are people saying about unionisation, collective bargaining and pay claims?
OK, well, again, you have to break it into public and private, because as you say, the collapse of social partnership has led to, if you like, a bilateral arrangement between the government and its direct employees, the public service, whereas the private sector has become an enterprise-based structure where individual employers deal with their individual unions or in-house representative bodies or whatever. But you don't have the same all-encompassing tripartite government, unions and employers entity that gave certainty for maybe 3-4 years overpay across the economy. So, you know, in the private sector, as I said, it is enterprise based. We're looking at pay settlements at the moment averaging 2.7, 2.8, up to 3. And that is the situation. So I think the bigger issue for the government going forward is going to be in the public sector, because it is directly the paymaster for around 340,000 workers. And the current pay deal, the Public Service Stability Agreement, is going to expire at the end of this year. They will need to have a new pay deal negotiated by October in order to know what financial envelope they need to set aside in the budget for the coming years on public service pay. But I think that there are a lot of difficulties in this. First, while most public servants have now had the pay cuts of the austerity restored. There are some at the top who still are not back where they started. But they are also going to, so they're going to be looking for pay rises. They're seeing the pay settlements in the public, in the private sector, and there is going to be a push for pay enhancement.
Well, we see things like inequality of pay in the education sector, where teachers are on different pay rates to others. We see also the government saying they want to incentivise consultants into the health system. We see the issue of defence forces pay in order to arrest the flow of people out of the defence forces. But if sectoral agreements are struck, we're back to the pre-benchmarking issue, and it's harder to strike an all-encompassing agreement if some people are seen to be special cases, because everyone sees themselves as a special case. Is that potentially tricky for the next government?
It's incredibly tricky. The first thing off, you mentioned the so-called new entrants. Do you realise, Colm, in December it'll be 10 years since those new pay scales were introduced. That means for 10 years, like, it's one thing to call someone a new entrant if they've been there for a year or two. 10 years is a long time, and that's the feeling of the unions. That's why this week alone we've seen the teachers out on strike about this issue. The Department of Education just last night revealed to me that it would cost them 400 million over the next 5 years to restore full pay equality to the new those 10 years of new entrants.
And that's before assuming, you get to the school secretaries who aren't paid
I'll come to those in a second. But bear in mind that that 400 million is only for teachers. The public service pay rates were cut across the public sector. So you've got new entrant guards, you've got new entrant physiotherapists, you've got new entrant nurses, you've got new entrant everybody. So the cost of restoring those new entrant pay scales would be huge. Then you've got, as you mentioned, the recruitment and retention issues, because yes, you can't get a consultant. Now, at what point does economics kick in on a supply and demand basis and say, if we can't get them, we have to increase the pay? But you know, the consultants are the highest paid in the public service. Do you want to reward them? How does that play politically? So there's, or do you just continue to situate a situation where you cannot get a psychiatrist in parts of the country or whatever? That's the trade-off. But then you also have what I would call the hybrid issues. You've got these staff who are not fully public service, but are funded by the public service. The
Such
Section 39 workers,
right, in
health bodies.
People who work in disability organisations who are paid according to public service scales and matched against them, but at the time of the downturn saw the reductions, but are not being now funded in order to restore pay as pay was restored to, say, like psychiatric nurses.
Yeah, they were cut on the way down in line with the public service, but haven't been restored on the way up in line with public services. Then you've got people like community employment scheme supervisors, who in 2008 were promised a pension scheme. They're not, like, all their schemes are funded by the government, but they're not, strictly speaking, public servants. Then you've got, for example, the school secretaries. They've been out on strike because they're not treated as public servants, although the secretaries in education and training boards are, with all the benefits of public service membership. And there's a lot of workers in that category. So that's something that's going to have to be addressed when they come round to negotiating a new pay deal.
So increased revenues for the government will bring these things to light, because an inability to pay is no longer there as an argument.
Well, let's wait and see. I mean, like, clearly, up to now, there has been a huge focus with the wind of austerity still being felt at people's backs, on stability, on caution, on rainy day funds, on all of that. And the government has been very keen to do that. But I think that demand is now pent up in the public service. And remember, they're also working in the sectors that are triggering the political fallout with, you know, I mean, if you're a nurse in the health service, you're seeing people at the cutting edge of a service that many feel isn't delivering to meet their needs.
Just go before we move on to the next issue, the when you were talking about precarious employment, the gig economy, etc., the whole issue of collective bargaining, the right to join a union, the status a worker enjoys, whether they're forced into a self-employment situation or whether they're regarded as an employee, and their rights to negotiate with an employer. Where is that at? Because a number of parties, I think Sinn Féin, Labour, People Before Profit, amongst them, are looking for a nailed down legislation in order to give people the right to collective bargaining, to join a union and to engage employers through that. So what is the situation with that?
The situation there is that there have been previous statutory attempts to deal with this. There was the 2004 Act, but that was effectively emasculated in a famous Ryanair case involving pilots and what have you. So that was set at naught. New legislation was put in place. It hasn't really been used by the unions effectively because it doesn't actually, you can discuss issues in a sort of a, you know, proximity talks way, but it still is difficult to apply. But I think that this is always going to be a difficult one, Colm, because there are two competing constitutional rights, the right to join a union and the right not to recognise one. So there would probably have to be a referendum. That would be the view of a lot of experts. Would any government hold a referendum on this? I'm not sure.
So people can join a union. The employer doesn't have to talk to them. And foreign direct investment, US multinationals, is one of the things hovering in the background there. Governments traditionally have not wanted to scare the horses by compelling foreign multinationals to sit down with trade unions. Would that be a kind of a complicating factor?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, like, I think that whatever about, you know, in indigenous firms, I think multinationals would be very resistant to anything that would force them to engage with unions. And, you know, that is one of the trickiest elements of industrial relations that has yet to be resolved.
OK, thanks, Ingrid.
Is that OK?
Yeah, perfect. Lovely job.
And that's all from this episode, the extra episode of Election 2020 Your Politics. We'll be back with another episode later on. But for now, from me, Colm O'Mungain, thanks for listening and goodbye.